This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You probably wouldn't have wanted to live the early life of Augustine Burroughs, yet he's managed to transform his dysfunctional and disturbing upbringing and early adulthood into a series of strangely amusing best-selling memoirs. Running with Scissors describes what happened when his mother, a poet who was mentally ill, gave him to her unorthodox psychiatrist to raise. A New York Times book review said the memoir promotes visceral responses of laughter, wincing, retching on nearly every page, and is funny and rich with child's-eyed details of adults who have gone off the rails. Burroughs' second memoir, Dry, is about working in advertising and getting sober. His new collection of essays, Magical Thinking, gets its title from a personality disorder whose predominant symptom is attributing to one's own actions something that had nothing to do with oneself, thus assuming that one has a greater influence over events than is actually the case. A little later, we're going to be discussing adult subjects that you might not want young children to hear about. Let's start with a reading from the first essay in Magical Thinking. It's called My Last First Date, and it's about meeting the man who became and remains Burroughs' partner.
We met at the Starbucks on Astor Place and 3rd Avenue. I'd answered his personal ad the week before, and we'd had a couple of long conversations on the phone. My first novel was just a week away from being published, and I had decided that it was time for me to date. It had been over a year since I'd dated anybody. I'd never dated anybody as a published author, and since being a published author is all I ever really wanted in life, I felt that I had never actually had a date as the real me. It was the old me that slept with one-third of the men in Manhattan. It was also the old me that drunkenly confessed to my last boyfriend that his famous best friend was the most sexually attractive man I'd ever seen in my life. When Dennis showed up, he was on time and in shorts. At this point, I didn't know that he was so mentally healthy. I only knew that he was extremely sexy and punctual. I had already ordered a double espresso, so he introduced himself and said, "I'm just going to run inside and grab a coffee." He threw me this smile that told me his first impression wasn't one of repulsion. His teeth were so white, I was certain they were all capped. But this, like silicone calf implants, was also fine with me. I am what's known as an early adopter. This means I had a laptop computer in 1984 when they were rare and the size of briefcases. I also had a cell phone that was larger than a loaf of bread. So new technologies have never frightened me away, even if these technologies are implanted into the body with the intention of making what's natural look better. When Dennis returned, he set his tall coffee on the table, then sat down, knocking his leg against the table and causing his coffee to slosh out. Shoot, he said, shoving his chair back. Oh, man, great. What a first impression. He looked at me with a genuinely disappointed and helpless expression on his face. I could tell he felt lousy and clumsy, and I was completely charmed.
That's Augustine Burroughs reading from his new book, Magical Thinking. So is this relationship the most normal thing that's ever happened to you?
Oh, you know, it is. And it took a while to get used to it first. You know, I've in my personal life, and I've always been drawn, I think, to very, very extreme individuals. People who maybe could be described as erratic. People who may be borderline manic depressive. And when I met Dennis, I was really at a different place in my life. I mean, like I said in this excerpt, I had just published my first book. You know, they'd paid me an astonishing advance of, you know, $25, and they were going to publish, you know, 17 copies of it. And you know what? I was never happier in my life. I mean, I was doing what I wanted to do. So I was in a really, really good sort of healthy state of mind. I'd been sober, you know, for a while. And Dennis came around the right person at the right time. And, you know, he is pretty normal in the sense that, you know, he's very responsible, and he's, you know, very for sort of, you know, together, I think you would say. He's very charming. He's very interested in other people and very good with people. He really listens. But he's eccentric too, you know. He's a brilliant, brilliant person. And he doesn't even know kind of how eccentric he is around the edges.
Well, in this piece in your book, you say that, you know, that you and Dennis didn't sleep together at first. You got to know each other in jazz clubs, on the Bowery at restaurants, on park benches, in Central Park at midnight. You say we were courting each other like people did in the 1940s. And I was wondering, what was it like for you to act in this kind of, you know, courting type of way when it was probably so foreign to everything you'd experienced? And, you know, you were hardly a virgin.
Yeah, oh my, it was the best time of my life. Dennis didn't want to rush in to sex, and to be honest with you, I didn't either.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering if you can return to that after having rushed into sex for so many years.
You know, I didn't want to, but I didn't really think I'd ever meet anybody. In this day and age, you know, it's, you know, you go on a date, maybe the second date, you have sex, you see how you get along in bed, you know, and you go from there. But I truly, in my heart, felt like I want to really love somebody before I sleep with them, you know, and try saying that on a first date, you know, or a second date to somebody, you know, and it's like, see you later. And that's exactly what Dennis is like. And he wanted to take things very slowly and not to leap ahead, you know, and not to force anything. And he also didn't want to, I think, have sex because he didn't want to get entangled with somebody sexually right away. He wanted to maybe get entangled sexually later, you know, after he knew that he had feelings, very strong feelings for that person. So we did. We waited, you know, until we really, 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 until I knew. We both knew, you know, something, this is a different relationship. This isn't like any other relationship I've ever had. We really, you know, we'd have a great date. We'd go out, we'd, you know, talk, so much talking. And I'd go home and I'd feel really peaceful. And that was absolutely new. I mean, I've not had a life of peace, and I've not had a life of, I don't know how to describe it other than just sort of saying emotionally full belly. That's not been my experience, but when we were dating, that was exactly the experience.
Yeah, well, for listeners who haven't been keeping up with your memoirs, let's do this. I'm going to ask you about one or two of the things that you feel most set you apart from other people.
Oh, well, you know, I think probably one of the things that sets me apart from other people is my upbringing, you know, that I talk about in Running with Scissors. Mm-hmm. And that's something that when I experienced it, you know, at the ages of 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 16 and a half, 17, I knew at the time this is an incredibly atypical thing I'm going through, you know. I was having an experience that was absolutely so far out of the norm. I mean, my mother was a very, very good poet in many ways, you know, early in her career, and she had an incredible hunger to be famous. Along the lines of Anne Sexton, you know, back in the 70s, I mean, Anne Sexton could fill an auditorium with 2,000 or 3,000 people, you know, a poet. And my mother wanted to be that level of celebrity. She was also manic depressive, and she would have psychotic episodes every fall, and later twice a year, sometimes three times. She had a very difficult marriage with my father, who was a heavy drinker, very, very heavy alcoholic, and a professor. And they sought couples counseling with a psychiatrist, and, you know, it didn't work, so they divorced. And the psychiatrist my mother engaged, you know, he had a certain charisma. He was a very short man, very sort of wide, white hair, thick white eyebrows, a white beard. He really looked like the image of Santa that we think of. And in fact, you know, there were times when he would wear a Santa hat, actually, while he watched the news in his house. But he had a very big personality. You know, he filled the room, even though he was a sort of a shorter man. He filled the room. And he was kind of like a cult leader, you know. He lived in a absolutely dilapidated Victorian in Western Massachusetts in Northampton, you know, the home of Smith College, absolutely run down to the ground, you know. The carpets were threadbare and covered with dog and cat hair. The furniture was overturned and stuffing was coming out of everything. And he lived with his biological family, which was rather large, but he also had an extended family. You know, his son, his adopted son, you know, Neil Bookman, was actually not his adopted son, but was a long-term patient. And Neil lived in the barn behind the house.
I was going to say, and then you soon became one of those members of the extended family in the house.
Right, so I was introduced into this, yeah.
Yeah.
I was introduced into this, and I was, you know, sort of that became my family. My mother dropped me off when I was 12, you know, for an hour visit here, 2 hours there, and before long I was there all the time. And eventually, you know, she signed the paperwork over and he became my legal guardian. So the doctor believed when you were 13 you were a free person. You know, you didn't have to go to school. You didn't have to do anything you didn't want to do. So we were like, you know, little crazy, you know, unbridled adults. And I began a sexual, physical relationship with a gentleman, you know, twice my age, who was, you know, obviously a very, very unstable guy. And that childhood, I think that experience of not having the socialization that school provides for you, you know, junior high school, being raised absolutely outside the norm. I mean, my childhood experience, which definitely shaped me in a lot of ways, is one of the very unusual things about me. And I think the other unusual thing that sets me apart from some people is that I experienced that, and then I spent all of my 20s very, 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 very drunk, and working in advertising. You know, I got a job when I was 19, because, you know, in advertising, it doesn't really matter, you know, what kind of a family you come from, or, you know, what school you went to. You know, basically, if you can write a better chuck wagon commercial, you know, you're in. So,
do you feel like you ever embellish to make the stories that happen to you more readable? And I'm sure a lot of readers wonder, do you ever just, like, make it up because it's such a good story?
No, you know what I do, though? Like Running with Scissors is a perfect example. I didn't embellish, but I cut a lot out because I could have written a very different book and it would have been intolerable to read, you know, a book about, you know, child molestation and being abandoned, you know, or sexual abuse and being abandoned by your mother and having to deal with a mother who's mentally ill. You know, what I did is I focused only on what I felt were sort of the absolutely eccentric, almost joyous aspects of such a debauched experience. Because, you know, there were quite a few things that I cherish, you know, memories I cherish. So I omitted the very dark, terrifying,
what?
You know, because I felt that if I had gone in that direction with Running with Scissors, it would have been too dark, and it would have made you not want to read it. It mm-hmm. would have made you, and you know what? I didn't want to write it. I mean, I remember when I started writing that book, the first thing I did, you know, I wrote a proposal for my publisher, and I said, you know, I had a kind of an unusual childhood, you know, and here's what it was like. And they said, you know, write the book. We like the proposal. Write the book. So I had like a year and a half, and I or 2 years, I think. Anyway, I flitted away half a year worrying. And then when I started to write, I began writing some of the I actually began writing one scene with me and you know, the doctor's patient, the pedophile, Neil. We were in a cornfield kissing, and I started writing that, and it just made me so uncomfortable. And I thought, oh, I'm never going to get through this book. I'm never going to be able to write this. It's too ugly. Because this is a childhood that I was very ashamed of throughout my 20s, you know, hence the drinking, you know, hence dry. And it was ugly. So I thought, you know, I'm going to start with something fun.
Now, your mother wasn't just eccentric. She was mentally ill. Was there an age where you were able to discern the difference between eccentricity and illness?
When I was very, very young, I think my mother was very, very good. When I was 5, 6, and 7, she used to read to me a lot, you know, and she used to pay a lot of attention. When I was 11 and 12, in that area, I used to look at her. And this is in the fall, when you know, when she would be leaving mentally, and I would notice something different in her eyes. My mother, you know, was always very exuberant. You know, she would paint, and if she wasn't painting, she would be writing, and if she wasn't writing, she would spend hours and hours doing a pen and ink illustration, or she'd be talking on the phone. She had, you know, lots of friends. She's a very, very exuberant, big person. You know, she sort of filled her life with a lot of projects and interests. But I think the defining period came when I would see her eyes, and what I saw in her eyes, I didn't recognize. There was a, and it's very difficult to describe what I'm going to, you know, sort of imagine quote marks, the look, but there was the look in her eyes that told me she was gone, you know, that it was almost as if she were somehow, you know, possessed. And it was scary. It was very, very, very scary. And immediately after I saw that look, you know, 1 or 2 days, her behavior would change. Mm-hmm. And she would get really manic. She would stop sleeping. And she would begin writing, you know, 50, 70, 80, 90-page poems. She would, you know, start, you know, 1 year she decoupaged the kitchen table, you know, with things from magazines and rejection letters from poetry journals. She got, you know, just hugely, hugely, enormously energetic. She would smoke her cigarettes down to the filter and then beyond, you know, and leave them burning. And she omitted a certain odor, you know.
What was your ideal of normal? If you could have been any, quote, normal person or lived in a, quote, normal family, what would that have looked like?
Oh, you know, probably very, very cliched. You know, there were some kids in school, you know, elementary school, that they used to do activities with their parents, you know, go camping or go on vacations. And that level of sort of intimacy, I guess, you know, like I don't know what that is like. I mean, I have adult friends now who are very, very close to their fathers and their mothers. And I'm just astounded sometimes, you know, as astounded as other people tend to be about my life, I'm equally astounded when I hear, you know, a friend of mine talk about some great conversation he had with his father and, you know, and how, you know, they went out and worked on the car together, you know, or whatever activity that was, because I never had that, you know, and I can't even imagine what that would be like.
So what was the last grade that you went to in school?
Well, the last grade I completed was the fourth, but then I went to a little bit of the fifth, a little bit of the sixth, a little bit of the seventh. And when I say a little bit, I mean under 28 days consecutively. And I had, you know, there's a compulsory education law in Massachusetts, or there was at the time, and you have to go to school till you're 16. But so what I would do is I would have, you know, the doctor would write excuses for me, you know, mental health excuses, medical excuses. And that would help, you know, that would get me a break for a while. He also, you know, gave me some pills and some liquor and said, you know, drink this and we'll fake a suicide attempt, you know. So I ended up in a psychiatric hospital for trying to kill myself, you know, although I did not try to kill myself. And that got me out of school for a while. So it was very patchy, you know, it was very, very patchy. After the fourth grade, it was very, very, very patchy. And, you know, that's one thing I actually regret. I think I kind of wish I had, you know, I ran away from school. School was in the way. It was very, very hard for me to focus on school when I had such unstable, you know, sort of home life. And I was involved in this, you know, I hate to use the word romantic relationship because it was far from romantic, this physical relationship with this person. And my life just felt so big, you know, at the age of 13 and 14 and 15, that there was no room for me to sit in class and memorize prepositional phrases, you know, and to go out and, you know, do little field trips or those things. And I felt like I had nothing in common with those kids, you mm-hmm. know. I mean, I came into school in the morning, you know, I didn't have a little Smurf keychain. I had, you know, razor burn on my cheek, you know, from making out. It was ugly. So
now, because your memoirs are so personal and because they reveal, you know, all the stuff about your sex life and your mother's mental illness and all this kind of chaos in your life and your former alcohol problem, etc., you have revealed a lot of things that other people would keep private. Have there been consequences for that? Are there any things that you regret are no longer private? Are there any things that you regret that anyone who reads your books would now know?
You know, it's ironic because I'm a very private person, personally, off the page. I'm very, very private. I've got, you know, a very tight, very small circle of close friends. And I don't go, you know, to parties and literary parties and events. I tend not to, unless I'm dragged. And I tend to, you know, be a real homebody with, you know, Dennis and the dogs. And it's funny revealing, you know, so much about myself. This is going to sound like a strange answer, but mm-hmm. I almost go into denial and don't think about it. So I have to just sort of have a line, well, not a line. I have to sort of have a policy, if you will, mentally, where I'm going to reveal it, you know, no matter how embarrassing it is to me, because I know now you know, from running with scissors and from dry, I know that there are other people out there who have felt or done or said exactly the same thing. You know, I mean, I've received letters from, you know, political officials and movie stars and rock stars and soccer moms and, you know, dads who stay, you know, all kinds of people, grandfathers, you know, people who were too young to read the book in the first place but did anyway. And so many of them will say, you know, that they can relate for whatever reason. You know, they went through this or they thought this or, you know, they wondered about this. There's the connection there. People kind of, I haven't had any sort of rejection. I've not had somebody say, I mean, with a few people, you know, get grossed out and think, oh, that's improper, you know, that's terrible, you know, that you would write, you know, in Running with Scissors about a 13-year-old boy having sex with a 30-whatever-year-old man. That's disgusting, you know, to have a sex scene like that. I feel tricked, you know, and my reaction to that is, you know, it's not a sex scene, actually. It's a criminal act, you know. It's in there because it's abuse, you know, and it's interesting and it's part of the story. So I try not to edit myself. Maybe that's like the alcoholic wild card, you know, just slip into denial. When I write, I write for myself. I don't think about, ooh, are people going to like this, you know?
No, as we've said, you know, Dry, your middle memoir, is about your period when you were an alcoholic. Did the 12-step program work for you? You're so verbal. And, you know, when you're really verbal, and very, very kind of facile with language, sometimes any kind of talking thing could be especially effective or especially ineffective because you can use a facility with words to do all kinds of denial type of things and to talk around anything.
I mean, it worked. It did work. I went, when I got out of rehab, I did something that they advocated, which was, you know, 90 and 90, 90 meetings in 90 days, which is, you know, every day you go to a meeting for 90 days. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and when I got out of rehab, I was so absolutely determined to never drink again. I mean, I knew I wouldn't. I knew I would be sober for the rest of my life, and I was terrified of relapsing. And, you know, I thought about relapsing every single day. I wasn't tempted to drink every day, but I thought about relapse every day, and I thought, it's out there somewhere, and it's not going to get me, you know? And when my life sort of fell apart in recovery, I mean, my best friend, Pighead in Dry, died. I decided to drink again, and because I didn't care, and so I drank. And to make a long story short, I ended up, you know, far more severely sick from alcohol than I had ever been before I was in rehab. I mean, I was drinking much more than I'd ever consumed in my life, and I actually got alcohol poisoning, which is something that I had, you know, assumed I must have had every other weekend, you know, for the past 10 years. But in fact, I hadn't. Alcohol poisoning is a very specific sort of condition. And I was hallucinating, and I had hives that were spreading up my arms and legs and chest all the way to my neck. And it was getting kind of difficult to breathe, and there was a metallic taste. And my liver, you know, when I stood up and looked in the mirror, I could see the outline of my liver, you know, through my skin. Mm. And my heart was beating so erratically that every time I would lie down to try to go to sleep, I would be startled awake. You know, we've all had one of those dreams where you're drifting off to sleep and you feel yourself stepping off a curb or a set of steps, and it startles you awake. And that's what it was like for me trying to sleep. So I knew I would die, you know, very, very, if I continued to drink. And so when I got sober for the last time, my whole sort of approach to it was very, very different. You know, I was no longer, you know, confident in terms of feeling that I had conquered alcohol in any way. I was terrified of alcohol. I had an enormous amount of respect for it and fear for it. I was drinking since I was 13, but an alcoholic probably since I was like 19. So I hadn't had a lot of experience sober, you know, and I found I really, really like being sober. I really like not being under the influence of anything. I mean, my own brain chemistry is more than enough. It's too much.
You know, at the beginning of your new book, Magical Thinking, you write, some names have been changed. Now, you changed your own name too, didn't you?
I did, yeah. When I was 18, you know, right after my birthday, I went to a Boston, Massachusetts courthouse, and I changed my first, middle, and last name. And the reason is because I wanted to be a new person. I wanted to reinvent myself. I did not want to be the person who went through such a grim, gross childhood. I wanted a fresh start. And I didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want my future to be dependent upon who I was and what I had gone through. I wanted to wipe the slate clean, so I changed my name, and I've now been, you know, Augustine Burroughs longer than I was my previous name.
Will you say your previous name?
Yeah, I was Chris.
Is Burroughs an homage to William Burroughs?
No, I'd never heard of William Burroughs. You know, I was, like I told you before, I had graduated from a really cheesy computer programming school, and Burroughs was a computer manufacturer in the 80s. They made, like, the Burroughs Tabulator. So I named myself after a computer. My middle name, Exxon, X-O-N, is also a computer term. And I don't know if it still is like an active term, but it meant a computer is either X on or X off. And X on means always in a state of accepting input. And I thought, no, that's a pretty great middle name. And Augustine sounded familiar, but a little bit different, you know, kind of classic and yet a little bit modern. You know, now I'm stuck with this ridiculous name. What's your name? Augustine Burroughs. You know, I wish it were, you know, Jim Smith. A nice two-syllable name.
Are there other Augustines in the world? I mean, I don't know any, but I figure there must be.
No, I don't think there are. Certainly not with my childhood.
Did you make up the name or did you get it from someplace?
No, I made it up, yeah.
And how did you make it up?
Well, you know, when you're a kid, there were like four or five Chrises in my elementary school. But, you know, remember when you were a kid and you were looking at all the other kids writing their names? Mm-hmm. And you like look at Ellen and then you want their letters because you're tired of your letters, you know? So I kind of just like took all the letters that I wanted from when I was a kid and put them together. You know, I got my A and my U and my G and U and S and T and E and N, and we ended up with that.
And for people who don't know your writing but just see your name, what do you think they guess you are, kind of, you know, ethnically or your religion, your class?
what
presumptions do they make based on Augustine Burroughs?
You know, I don't know. It sounds fairly Northern European, I think, doesn't it? Burroughs, yes, Burroughs.
It sounds
Burroughs.
Kind of upper crust to me, yes.
It does sound kind of upper. I like that about it.
Oh, it sounds like you should.
It elevates me.
Like having a martini in an exclusive club.
It is, exactly.
Well, Augustine Burroughs, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Augustine Burroughs' new book is called Magical Thinking.